Item number 12, forage fish and commercial smelt fishery. This is a briefing, and Dr. Davey.
All right. Mr. Chair, members of the commission, Mr. Director, welcome today. Today I get the honor of coming to talk to you about some of the most exciting fish in the state of Washington. And if you think I'm joking, I really hope you don't when I'm done here. These are critical, critical species, and it's one of my favorite things to talk about, to you guys, to the public, to anybody and everybody. I'm going to cover a lot of ground today. I've got some people with me that can answer questions. I can answer questions. I am always happy to talk to any of you about forage fish at any point, anywhere. So to start off, just a brief outline. I'm going to talk about what forage fish are, why they're important to the ecosystem, and why I really am so excited about them. And then I'm going to talk about how we manage these species in the state of Washington. Again, I'm not going to go into every detail, but I'm going to tell you a little bit about what we know, what we don't know, some of the gaps that we deal with, some of the challenges, and then some of the really new things that we're doing with these species. So first off, what makes a fish a forage fish? Why do we group these fish together? Well, they're not necessarily a genetic group, they're an ecological group. And the key thing about forage fishes is that they are generally at the middle of the food web. So they tend to be small, abundant, schooling fishes. These are things like herring and sardine and anchovy and these smelts and other schooling species. They get eaten by everything. Fish, whales, birds, wolves, believe it or not, all kinds of things eat forage fish. And because of that, they play this pivotal role in the marine food webs, where all of the energy generated by photosynthesis from plankton and then eaten through the zooplankton passes through these fish up to these higher level consumers. So without these fish in the ecosystem, there's no way that these bigger predators can feed on the lower food chain items. So they don't generally eat zooplankton except maybe at an early stage in their life history. So you've got this conduit group of species that pass energy from the bottom of the food web to the top. These fish are also commercially important around the world, and everybody's always startled by this, but they account for 40% of overall marine harvest on a worldwide basis. Now, at first you think, really? Smelt is 40%? Well, no. This is anchovy, anchoveta, sardine, all of these other big fishery species. But they are critically important to harvest, so not just ecology, but economy. They're also a great indicator of ecosystem health, because if you don't have something for these higher order predators to eat, they disappear. Plain and simple, they starve out. So if you don't have forage fish, you don't have these higher order predators. Now, one thing that forage fish are not, by Washington state law, is a lot of silvery, small, schooling fish. This is just a function of the way that we define things by law. So I won't talk about hake, pollock, juvenile salmon, all of these other things that are small, silvery, schooling fish. But ecologically, these are forage species. They do get eaten by a lot of things above them. One thing that's kind of a hallmark of forage fish is that their populations fluctuate wildly. And you can see a figure here showing anchovy and sardine catch. And interestingly, during certain ocean regimes, some populations or some species do very well. And during other regimes, other species will do very well, depending on what they eat, how they grow, which portions of the habitat they like to utilize. And so you tend to get these huge swings based on ocean conditions. And in some cases, these can be 10, 20, 30 times the size of a population, either up or down. So managing these species is incredibly complex, because one year you may have plenty for the ecosystem, for fisheries, for all of these other things, and the next year they're gone. And then they'll reappear a few years later. So you may have these swings. In some cases, they coincide with the things like the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which is an indicator of the ecosystem. Sometimes it's not clear what causes these swings. But even accounting for this variability, there are many stocks of forage fish around the world that have been declining over the past three decades. Why have they been declining? Well, a lot of things. Climate change, poor water quality, overfishing, fishing at an inappropriate time, so fishing on those peaks and then not adjusting the quotas after that peak starts to decline. Habitat loss, a variety of different things can threaten these fish. And the department and the commission actually in the late 90s was really proactive about trying to manage these species. In 1998, there was a policy put forward by the commission that set out a couple of different goals. And the big goal was to maintain healthy populations of these fish. specifically because the policy recognized that they're very important in the ecosystem. It also said that if you don't have enough data, you have to be conservative about managing these species. It also said that maximum yield, or fishing as much as we possibly can, won't be a goal. Fishing enough to support economy and support fisheries when these are bait fish used for other fisheries makes sense, but trying to take every last fish, not a goal for forage species. It also said that we should use science to do our management. And in 1998, this was really proactive for forage fish. This wasn't the case in other areas up and down the West Coast, let alone the world. There were a lot of fisheries that were still going gung-ho in the 90s. So today, when I talk about these different species, what I'm going to talk to you about is three different major aspects of each one or each group. The way that we manage the fishery, our stock assessment and monitoring work, and then habitat documentation and protection. All of these things were called out in the policy and later in our forage fish management plan that was also authored in 1998. So I'm going to focus on two big groups of forage fish today. The first one is all of our clupeid style fishes, which are the first three here, and then also Pacific sand lance because they fit on this slide better than later. So first we'll talk about herring, anchovy, sardine, and then a bit about Pacific sand lance. And then later in the talk we'll move on to smelt. So for Pacific herring, we used to have fairly big fisheries inside Puget Sound and some on the outer coast of Washington. And this was on the order of thousands of metric tons. So these were big fisheries. Nowadays, we only have fisheries that are on the order of a couple hundred metric tons. And actually, we've got a few of our commercial fishermen today, and I think one of our commercial buyers that are going to give some testimony about the importance of these fish. The goal, being conservative and based on our policy for these fisheries, has always been to take less than 10% of the annual biomass that we assess for these stocks. Now, in reality, we really only take 3 to 5% most years. So we're being fairly conservative there with our fisheries management. How do we assess that stock? How do we determine how many of these fish are out there? Well, herrings spawn on subtidal vegetation. So they come into nearshore shallow areas and they lay their eggs over vegetation that's growing on the bottom. And so we've assessed these stocks two different ways over the years. We had one, the acoustic trawl surveys, where we went out to areas that these herring would hang out prior to coming into spawn, and we would run over them with a high-resolution fish finder, essentially. We would look at the density of the fish in that area, and then we would drag a trawl through it and use the information that we got from that trawl, including the size of the fish, the sex ratio, a variety of different things, to predict how many spawners were involved in that school. This was cut after 2009 due to funding and some outdated equipment that we had, and this is where I'll put in a shameless plant, Commissioner Carpenter, to ask me about that at the end. Method number two that we use is spawn deposition surveys. So like I said, the fish come in and they hold for a while before moving into the shallows. When they move into the shallows, we go in and we use a rake, which you can see Kurt holding down here in the bottom corner. We use a vegetation rake, and we go out and systematically survey these spawning areas, pulling up vegetation, looking at the density of eggs that have been deposited on that vegetation, and then ultimately back calculating that to the number of fish that it would have taken to place that many eggs. And so we get an estimate, again, of the spawning biomass that went into the production of those eggs in each area. Since 2010, after shutting off our acoustic trawl surveys, this has been our primary status assessment method for herring. We have 22 stocks of herring in Puget Sound, and so each of these bubbles here, each of these polygons, is an individual stock. In this case, stock was defined by just geography and spawn timing. We do have some genetic information, and ultimately there are three genetic groups that we can currently identify. There's the Cherry Point herring up here in the north. Even though they overlap geographically, they spawn later in the year than the Semiyamu stock. We also have the Squaxin Pass stock down here in the south. And then we have all the other stocks, which genetically cannot be differentiated. So we manage those three different groups. The Cherry Point stock here in the north has declined substantially since the 1970s, and it's actually declined more than 96%, our estimates of spawning biomass. There's a variety of reasons for this, some of which we don't yet fully understand, but it's definitely a mixture of mechanisms. It's predation, it's overfishing, it's habitat degradation, it's a variety of different things that contributed to this. These other stocks in the middle, the other stock complex, the abundance has varied substantially over time. In the past few years, the quilcene stock here in North Hood Canal has been the one really carrying the abundance for this group. It's increased over fivefold since the 1970s. So we use these two methods. We assess the stock. We utilize that to manage the fisheries. As far as habitat protection is concerned, the spawning and the holding habitats that we've identified through our surveys, both where we used to do acoustic trawl surveys and where the eggs are actually deposited, are defined as saltwater habitats of critical concern, and they're protected by the no net loss provision in our WACs. So this is a part of our HPA law that says essentially you can't just go out and destroy spawning grounds. They're critical. And if you do, for some reason, have to destroy them, there needs to be appropriate mitigation. So with herring, because this is a species that's important to fisheries and that's very important to the ecosystem and that we've had money to do research on them with, we've got a lot going on with herring. And so right now, in addition to all of that management, we're also branching out into a bunch of different things, like assessing if there's a preference or not for the type of vegetation upon which eggs are laid, looking at toxic contamination in these fish, because when they get eaten by everything else, you get bioaccumulation of these toxins. We're looking into genetic methods to try and differentiate all of those fish in the other stocks complex. We're evaluating a variety of different things here. We also just recently received funding from the SeaDoc Society to coordinate with Canadian scientists and with First Nations and tribes in the U.S. to specifically write an assessment and then a long-term monitoring plan for not only herring in Puget Sound, but herring in the whole of the Salish Sea, which is all of the Canadian inside waters and Puget Sound. So this is a broad collaborative effort that simply has never moved forward before because of disconnects across the border. So we're really excited about this one. For anchovy and sardine, these are species that, for the most part, are in our offshore waters. We do have both species in Puget Sound, but their abundance, again, fluctuates wildly inside the sound. And ultimately, the abundance of them on the outer coast is managed by the Pacific Fisheries Management Council. And they're part of the Coastal Pelagic Species Fisheries Management Plan, or the Coastal Pelagic Species Complex. And there have been several recent changes to their management. Lorna Wargo, one of our department biologists and researchers, is the lead of the Coastal Pelagics Work Group, and she's actually very well-versed on this. Rather than get into the details here, she actually just said, tell them I'm willing to come in and talk. So if you want more details here, bring Lorna in. For stock assessment, they do get assessed, but they get assessed on a coast-wide basis, and it's either periodic or annual. Anchovy are not assessed as frequently. There are massive nearshore schools, though, still out there right now, and for the most of 2016, they were being observed all up and down the coast. This included inside Puget Sound. We think this is because of the warm water blob offshore and a distribution of fish moving inshore to stay away from the warmer water. Changes in the food web, a variety of different things may have spurred this. Quite honestly, we haven't had the money to research it, though. We haven't had the staff. We haven't had the time. So right now, we're just guessing. And this is on a coast-wide basis, we're guessing. There's not really anybody that's monitored these in the extreme nearshore. So we hope to be able to do that in the future. For habitat protection, there has been essential fish habitat, or EFH, designated for these species in 2010. And so this is a mechanism to protect their habitat under federal law. There are no directed state laws or rules, though, that protect spawning habitat or any habitat for these species. So sand lance is another species that we've studied pretty extensively, but only parts of its life cycle. For fisheries management, there are no significant fisheries. And in fact, in the policy in 1998 and ultimately in the forage fish management plan, we said, we don't want commercial fisheries. We're going to leave this fish for the ecosystem. So we set this fish aside and prohibited commercial fisheries on it. As far as spawning or stock assessment and monitoring, we know that these fish spawn throughout Puget Sound in the intertidal. So instead of laying their eggs in the water, these fish actually wait until high tide. They come and spawn in the very, very near shore. And then when the tide goes down, the eggs are left high and dry on the beach, where they stick to sand grains and embed into the sand. There's been a lot of work done with this since the 70s when they were first noted. And you can see here, the green side of this is all of the places that have been surveyed since the 70s, and the orange side here is all of the places that we found sand lance eggs. So they've been found throughout Puget Sound. They're important throughout the sound. On the outer coast, we have very little information here. We did a project a few years ago for surf smelt on the outer coast. We didn't find any sand lance eggs. They are predominantly winter spawners, and there's some hint that they may spawn subtidally. We really, again, right now, don't have the time, the ability to go out and assess this, but this has been found in other sand lance species in Alaska and in northern British Columbia, and so we think that this might be a possibility. So we're trying to look at mechanisms to do that. As far as habitat protection, this is another forage species where their spawning habitats have been designated as critical habitat, and under WAC, they're also protected by that same no net loss provision. As far as current research, we've been doing a bunch of different things. We have a partnership between WDFW and DNR and the Washington Conservation Corps, and over the past couple of years, the Corps, we've been able to get two Corps crews every year that go out and do intensive surveys. So they're covering a lot of ground looking for both surf smelt and sand lance eggs. Surf smelt is another species that spawns intertidally and on similar beaches. Ultimately, we've got a lot of new information there, and this is a huge data compilation effort, lots of partners, and it's been moving forward really well the last couple of years. In fact, in 2015, additional work to do this was funded directly by the state legislature. So that was a really big shot in the arm for our forage fish program. We're also developing and testing new methods for recovery of eggs from sediment samples. So to find these eggs, what we physically have to do is actually go to the beach where they've laid them, sift through the sediment and sift through the dirt to find the eggs, and then separate them and quantify them. It's about as much fun as it sounds, but there are more effective ways to do it. And Phil Dion, which you heard from this morning when he discussed a tagging project we've been working on with forage fish, has been developing methods to do this. And so the old method to do it was scoop up a bunch of sand, pour it in a wash pan, slosh it around like crazy until you can separate most of the eggs, and then go from there. We've also tried a couple of different methods, but ultimately now we have this reverse gold panning method going on. This blue bowl over here is actually a gold panning tool where you pour in the sediment, it creates a funnel and a vortex effect, and the gold would settle out to the bottom, the eggs go out the middle. We want the eggs. That's white gold to us. We love those. We have found a few gold flakes, but not nearly enough to retire on yet. Give it a few years. We've also got an ongoing beach sanding and tagging effort at Friday Harbor Labs, working in collaboration with the University of Washington. And that's over here. You can see these fish that have been tagged with a polymer that you inject under the skin. And when you hit it with UV light, it glows. So we're doing a series of tagging projects up there with a couple of different students and a professor up there, and essentially just trying to get more life history information on these fish, which we have very little of. We know a lot about where they spawn, but little else. So the second major group of fish that I'm going to talk about, there's really only two smelt that we have much information for, and that's the surf smelt and the Yulican. These other smelt down here at the bottom, the night smelt, which we know so little about that this was the best picture I could find of them, the longfin smelt, and the whitebait smelt, essentially we know so little about that there's not really much worth briefing you on. So I won't talk about them. Surf smelt and Yulican, though, we've done quite a bit of work with. So for surf smelt, this is something that we've talked to you about a couple of different times over the last few years, and it's because of the fisheries changes that we've had. We have both commercial and recreational fisheries in Puget Sound and on the outer coast for these species. For the recreational fish, this can be done with either dip nets or jigs. It's mostly dip nets, we think. We don't actually have the capacity to monitor this. We do know that people jig for it, or at least we think we know that. We've seen a few here and there. By and large, the harvest is essentially unknown. We've done a couple of small projects, but we really don't have the capacity to monitor these folks. And as we've talked about in the past, currently you do not require, license is not required to fish for surf smelt. In fact, a license is not required to fish for any species of smelt in Washington State. And that's really important in a minute when I talk about the ESA-listed Yulican. So, from a recreational standpoint, like I said, we've had a couple of chances to evaluate this. We did a study in 2012 off the northern end of Kamano Island, and we found that in a typical season, about a three-month summer season, they took approximately 4,000 pounds of fish. Now, what does this mean relative to the population of surf smelt? We don't know. We've never made an abundance estimate for surf smelt. We've never had the capacity to do that. From a commercial standpoint, We have had harvest in Puget Sound for decades, and we've got harvest data going back to the 70s. And a couple of years ago, in 2013 and 14, attention was drawn to the fact that there's a substantial shift in the harvest level in the 60s and 70s and into the 80s and the 90s to 2000s. So we brought this before the commission, a briefing was requested, and ultimately we made some changes to the fishery. We closed the commercial fishery on Sunday. We implemented a night closure, which was also implemented for the recreational fishery. And we closed some inactive gear types. So essentially now the commercial fishery is just by drag seine or beach seine in the near shore. We also enacted a harvest quota of 60,000 pounds. Assuming that for some reason or another, this increase in the harvest was a bad thing, right? These are fish that feed other predators and feed the ecosystem, and that assuming that the harvest from the 70s and 80s was more sustainable, essentially the policy was set to lower that quota or set a quota at that lower level from the 70s and 80s. And what this did was require us to do some things like in-season management, which we had not currently done with this fishery. Up to then, the fishery was essentially market limited. If they didn't have somewhere to sell the fish, they wouldn't catch more fish. So they fished for a few months out of the year. They took on average 100,000 pounds. So when we implemented this, the first year that it kicked in was 2014. And essentially no fishing occurs until June, even though we do have some areas that are open year-round. But between June and September or October, all of the harvest occurs. And so the first year in 2014, we were just over that 60,000-pound quota. In 2015, we were almost right on it. And now in 2016, again, just over, about 1.4% over the quota. But we've been able to keep the harvest pretty steady right at that 60,000-pound mark. So, like I just said, commercial harvest now is right around that 60,000-pound mark. Again, this is a species that we know spawns intertidally throughout Puget Sound. And this is the same figure on the left here in green for area that's been covered where surveys have occurred on the beach. But this is now for surf smelt, the distribution of where we know that they've been detected or where we found eggs. They, again, spawn intertidally on the beaches. They utilize beaches that are a little bit different from the sand lance. They prefer a little bit more coarse gravel. And their spawning time varies. They typically spawn in the summer in the north and the winter in the south. And that's kind of been an old adage for these species or for this species for several decades. With more work from the Washington Conservation Corps and this funding from the legislature, we're actually finding that most places they spawn year round. There are definitely peaks to their spawning, but in most cases they spawn year round. Like I mentioned before, we do not have population estimates for these species. We recently finished some genetic work with them, though, and right now it doesn't look like there's any stock differentiation. We've run two different types of genetic tests, and we're working on some more. But right now it doesn't look like there's any differentiation among groups of these fish that are spawning throughout the Sound. For habitat protection, again, they're spawning areas defined as critical areas of are critical saltwater habitats of concern and, again, protected by this no net loss provision. So with surf smelt, we've been doing a lot lately. The genetics was one thing that I just mentioned, and we're working on publishing that right now. We've got a spawning habitat preference model, and this is a variety of different things, but basically trying to get at what is it about the habitat that makes these fish choose a specific spot as the one to spawn in. So we're looking at a variety of different attributes, sediment size, shading, the scope of the tidal flux, a variety of different things. We're also trying to do a comprehensive assessment of spawning distribution throughout Puget Sound, and this is the work with the Washington Conservation Corps and funded by the legislature. Using that tagging method I talked about earlier for sand lance, we've also been doing a mark recapture study, and Phil Dion spoke to you about that earlier today down in Eld Inlet. And in Sinclair Inlet, we've been working with the U.S. Geological Survey, USGS, to do surgical implantation of acoustic tags. So we've been trying to tag these fish. And what all this really comes down to is trying to figure out where they go when they're not spawning, because we really don't know the answer to that right now. They show up here and there in different catches, different kinds of survey methods, but not at the levels where you would expect, given how many of them we see spawn in the near shore. We've also been assessing the impacts of armoring and adherence with HPA permit provisions and how it impacts the spawning habitat. for these species. We also have a model to determine beach use for HPA purposes, and ultimately this comes down to defining, for a given survey on the beach, how representative of the entire beach is that. And so for a survey in one location, can we say that appropriate habitat spawning or spawning habitat exists for a given interval along the beach? So this is academic in some ways, but ultimately it guides our HPA process. For Ulacan, again, this is a species for which a lot has been happening, but I'm not the expert on it, and we've had a huge change that I'll talk about in just a minute. So I'll refer you to Olaf Langness. Again, I talked to him. He'd be happy to come in. We have had fisheries on this species in the past, but fisheries have been closed since 2010 due to ESA listing. Now, when I say closed, you can see there's an asterisk there. They aren't all closed. We occasionally have fisheries, and there are still a few days on large abundance years where we allow recreational fishing and commercial fishing on these. But they are ESA listed from northern Vancouver Island and kind of northern central British Columbia all the way down to the Columbia River. Their abundance is being estimated on the Cowlitz River and the Grays River, and recently there was a four-year study that was completed and published. Again, that's Olaf Langness and his crew. And we're making efforts to try and document spawning habitat for these fish on the outer coast. Again, we don't know everywhere that they spawn, but there are lots of stories, especially tribal knowledge from several of the tribes on the outer coast, saying that these fish come up a variety of rivers out there that are not currently included as critical habitat for these species under the ESA. So there's been an effort to try and document that. Like I just said, their habitat is, or there has been critical habitat designated. That was designated in 2011, and it includes some rivers, but not nearly all of the ones that we have anecdotal evidence anyway to suggest they used to spawn in or could still spawn in. The fisheries have been reduced, like I mentioned. We do have them occasionally. Again, though, oddly enough, you don't need a license if you're recreationally fishing for these fish. So they are ESA listed. It might be just a few days at a time, but we do have fisheries on them. What we've been doing with those fisheries, though, is actually using the recreational fishers to help us sample. So if they go out and they can dip and they can catch fish very easily, we can get age, sex ratio, fecundity, a variety of different biological aspects that are critical to their management. We do have another set of sampling that's going on in the Upper Columbia River estuary. This is mostly looking at larval outmigration and eggs washing out of the system. And again, this is in an effort, kind of like we do with the herring, to use the eggs to estimate how many individuals must have been involved in producing those eggs. And the big change that I mentioned earlier is this draft federal recovery plan. This was released in October of this year and is still currently under public review. But this is a big deal for these fish. And as I mentioned, Olaf Langness has been heading up a bunch of the research. He's also on the planning team that produced this draft recovery plan. All of the management, all of the research that I've talked about thus far is pretty much single species focused. And at the beginning, I started talking about forage fish by saying that as a group, they're critical to the ecosystem. So in 2015, this legislative bill that I talked about earlier that's currently funding our beach surveys also funded a midwater trawl survey. And at this point, I'm not going to give you much detail on this survey because it's still ongoing. But what we've been doing is every other month since February of 2016, we've been going out and doing this extensive midwater trawling effort. And this is actually using equipment that we could use to do acoustic trawl surveys like we used to do. It's substantially upgraded equipment from what we used to have. And what we've been doing is going to these 18 different locations throughout Puget Sound, running acoustic transects, and then capturing all the fish we can in the net. And what we're catching is a variety of forage fish, herring, smelt, anchovy, all these different things. We're also catching the occasional salmon, a variety of other things, but we're also getting information about jellyfish and things that you might not think about in the midwater. This is incredibly important because this will really allow us to do ecological surveys of the area and really start to interpret what we're seeing out there and put that into context. It is a significant stride towards trying to really consider these species as a group as opposed to individual species management. So we're really excited about this, and I very much hope that you guys will invite us back to talk about this after it's completed in June and we've got the report written up and really can talk about the nuts and bolts of what's there. So to pull that all together, I've got a table here showing some of the basic things that we know and things that we do with forage fish. And there's a lot to digest here, but I think I've highlighted a few things here that I think are really worth noting. For a lot of these species, we don't have basic biological information. And what I mean when I say that is we don't know how many of them there are. We don't have stock assessments for them. We may or may not know how long they live. We may or may not know whether they spawn once and die or whether they spawn multiple times over the course of their life. We are missing some fundamental pieces to being able to manage these species actively. The monitoring of the stock condition here, all of this basic biological information pulls into those monitoring efforts. And so in some cases, without that information, we simply can't do real stock assessment. We can't talk about what's really out there and how it's being utilized by either people or other elements of the ecosystem. A critical thing here I want to draw attention to is the habitat loss risk. So for some of these species, especially herring, sandlance, and surf smelt that spawn in the nearshore, there's definitely a conflict with utilization of that nearshore by people. And with sea level rise and bulkheads and armoring of beaches, there's a lot of concern about habitat loss for these species. And so when you kind of put this together, you get a perfect storm. We know very little about some of these species, and we know that there's a big potential for risk to them. And so the need to really be proactive about their management is definitely there. And then one thing that I'll throw in, just because I want to again, is recreational fisheries on smelt. We don't have a license. So with that, I'll take any questions that you have, and then I also just want to throw this contact up there. While I'm head of the Puget Sound Research Division that works with this, Lorna Wargo oversees policy on the coast. Phil Dion is in our habitat program, and you heard from him earlier. He mostly does the intertidal survey work. And then Todd Sendell, Adam Lindquist, and Patrick Biondo, all of which are sitting behind me here, two of which are fairly new to the department, are our herring guys, our statewide herring guys. And then Olaf Langness does Ulican work down on the Columbia River and a variety of other things. So if you have any further targeted questions, these are the folks to go to. But at this time, I'll take anything that you've got.
Thank you, Davey. Questions?
Commissioner? Well, I guess, Dr. Lowry, were you suggesting that we should engage with the legislature to do something about recreational smelt so we know a little bit more, have some budgetary help and have some tools to work with to learn more about what we need to know?
I think that's very well put. I wouldn't presume to tell you guys what to do, but it would certainly make our job a lot easier if we had the ability to know how many people were participating in the fishery and we had some way to really track and estimate this harvest and to really get a handle on the impact on the species.
I think the director was listening. Yeah. Food for thought, certainly.
Commissioner Carpenter, if maybe I could help respond to that. In the Washington's Wild Future legislative package, the department has included language in that request to require a license to fish for smelt. So if that is successful this session, then we would have that requirement in place.
Thank you, Craig.
Do you have any information on the plankton database that might be feeding these forage fishes? Do we have any information whatsoever on fluctuations in the plankton database? We used to collect these samples years ago on a regular basis, but my understanding now is we have very little new information on what's happening within the plankton.
Yes, that's definitely true. So historically, there was sampling that occurred. There is still sampling that's occurring. The coordination among that sampling has been a bit lacking, but in recent years there have been efforts, mostly by staff at the University of Washington, Dr. Julie Keister, and a group of folks up there that have been working on trying to get baseline surveys for plankton throughout Puget Sound. We've been doing that as part of the Midwater Trawl Survey. So all of these 18 stations that we hit every other month, we've been collecting plankton tows as well. Also for bottom fish, I oversee the crew that does our bottom fish survey every May. And so for the last 3 years at all of our bottom fish trawl surveys, we've also been taking plankton samples. So we've got a more coordinated, more systematic effort going forward right now. Pulling it all together into an interpretable summary right now is a bit elusive.
But how do they treat the plankton data sets or the samples that they collect? Are they using DNA processes to identify species within the mix?
So currently we haven't. What we've been doing is collecting and then directly pickling the samples in formalin or ethyl alcohol. In ethyl alcohol, you can later get DNA out of the samples, but there has been some talk, specifically with Ryan Kelly up at University of Washington, about trying to use eDNA. And eDNA is a technique where basically you take a water sample and you fine filter all of the particulates in it.
Yeah.
Those particulates include things like cells sloughed off from fish. So if they've lost any skin cells or slime or anything that would pull epithelial or skin tissue with it, you get that DNA in your sample.
But have they applied that to a plankton analysis? Are they trying to identify species that are of importance within the plankton?
No, not that I'm aware of. It is something that we've been discussing, but it's not something that I've seen used for plankton anywhere yet. They've used it to try and identify specific species in a system, but in many cases it's been freshwater systems. It's expanding to the marine world, though. Mm-hmm. And actually, I see that Rich has joined me here to talk about what the shellfish unit is doing with plankton.
Yeah, Dave is correct on how they're at the University of Washington. Dr. Keister's lab is doing the keying out down of the species on the various plankton. And a lot of this plankton sampling is being coordinated through the Long Live the Kings program. And we, the department, our crew, we are actually in charge of sampling. There's index stations that have been established around Puget Sound. We have four of those index stations, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, that we've sampled now 3 years, and we plan on continuing that process. So we sample twice a month from April through September. So,
how do you sample?
There's plankton tow nets, and it's a vertical sample tow net as well as a horizontal. I think it's 15-minute horizontal tow as well. But they're experimenting with a lot of different techniques on using DNA and so forth to key out down to the species. But right now, it's still physically technicians counting under a microscope.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. The herring stocks, the 22 different Puget Sound stocks, do they leave the sound? Is there a migratory path, or do they do their entire life cycle within the Puget Sound area?
Yes, no, maybe, and we don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good answer.
We do have some tagging data from back historically in the 70s and early 80s showing that for some stocks they do actually migrate, especially the northern sound stocks.
Right.
They migrate out of the sound. There are Canadian stocks that are known to migrate south of the Fraser River through the San Juans and around the southern corner of Vancouver Island. We do have some stocks for which we don't know. We really don't have a feel for how they move or where they go, and that's part of why we've been making this effort to find a genetic tool that can help us differentiate individual stocks.
Oh, yeah.
If that were the case, and we were to catch these fish in aggregate, you know, somewhere out in the middle of the San Juan Channel or something, we would be able to key each fish back to a population. And so we've been working with Dr. Lorenz Hauser up at University of Washington trying to do that.
Okay. And I was thinking, like, this population in Quilcene Bay may not make it all the way through the Salish Sea and out to the Canadian San Juans, but that'd be interesting because within the Puget Sound region, I would think that habitat's got to be a tremendous... I'm surprised that you can find that many various stocks that still exist within Puget Sound with the issues. So, and I think... what Commissioner Mankin raised is interesting because, as you say, these feed the bigger fish, and something feeds them, and those plankton stocks are just as important to understand as these stocks, too, within the whole picture.
Yes, yes, so, absolutely.
Now, this is very interesting, and I appreciate the work you've done, all of you guys, really.
And like I said, we really have just kind of scratched the surface, even though I ran over time here. So I would be happy to talk to you guys at any point about any other details or anything that piqued your interest today.
It's important work. Thank you.
I would like to put exclamation marks around "to be continued" on this issue. There's just a lot here we don't know, you don't know, and this is what you guys do. And I think it's incumbent upon us to know more so we can provide suggestions and oversight. So we'll talk again. And we're behind schedule, so I'm not running you off, but I want to make sure we have a chance to do this again in more detail.
I think I'm on the next agenda item, too, so I'll just stay here.
Stay right there.
But thank you.
For-